Snaking across the open tarmac of the taxiway was the thin black electrical cable that connected the aircraft to the main supply, a long, vulnerable umbilical cord. Peter studied it thoughtfully before turning his attention to the four Panhard armoured cars. A little frown of irritation crossed his forehead. "Colonel, please recall those vehicles." He tried not to let the irritation come through in his tone. "With the turrets battened down, your crews will be roasting like Christmas geese." "General, I feel it's my duty," Boonzaya began, and Peter lowered the glasses and smiled. It was a charming, friendly grin that took the man by surprise after the previous stern set of features. And yet the eyes were devoid of humour, cracking blue and hard in the craggy granite of the face. "I want to defuse the atmosphere as much as possible." The necessity to explain irked Peter, but he maintained the smile. Somebody with four great cannons aimed at him is more likely to make a bad decision and pull the trigger himself. You may keep them in close support, but get them out of sight into the terminal car park and let your men rest. With little grace, the colonel passed the order over the walkie-talkie on his belt, and as the vehicle started up and slowly pulled away behind the line of hangars, Peter went on remorselessly. "How many men have you got deployed?" He pointed to the line of soldiers along the parapet of the observation balcony, and then to the heads, visible as specks between the soaring blue of the African sky and the silhouette of the service hangars. 230. "Pull them out," Peter instructed, "and let the occupants of the aircraft see them go."
"All of them?" incredulously.
"All of them," Peter agreed, and now the smile was wolfish. "And quickly, please, Colonel." The man was learning swiftly, and he lifted the miniaturized walkie-talkie to his mouth again. There were a few moments of scurrying and confusion among the troops on the observation deck before they could be formed up and marched away in file. Their steel helmets, like a bobbing line of button mushrooms, and the muzzles of their slung weapons would show above the parapet and would be clearly visible to an observer in the Boeing.
"If you treat these people, these animals..."
The colonel's voice was choked slightly with frustration.
"If you treat them soft..."
Peter knew exactly what was coming. "And if you keep waving guns in their faces, you will keep them alert and on their toes, Colonel. Let them settle down a little and relax. Let them get very confident." He spoke without lowering the binoculars. With a soldier's eye for ground, he was picking the site for his four snipers. There was little chance that he would be able to use them. They would have to take out every single one of the enemy at the same instant. But a remote chance might just offer itself, and he decided to place one gun on the service hangar roof. There was a large ventilator which could be pierced and would command the port side of the aircraft. Two guns to cover the flight deck from both sides. He could use the drainage ditch down the edge of the main runway to get a man into the small hut that housed the approach radar and ILS beacons. The hut was in the enemy's rear. They might not expect fire from that quarter. Point by point from his mental checklist, Peter planned his dispositions, scribbling his decisions into the small, leather-covered notebook, poring over the large-scale map of the airport, converting gradients and angles into fields of fire, measuring ground to cover and time to target for an assault force launched from the nearest vantage points, twisting each problem and evaluating it, striving for novel solutions to each, trying to think ahead of an enemy that was still faceless and infinitely menacing. It took him an hour of hard work before he was satisfied. Now he could pass his decisions to Colin Noble on board the incoming Herc, and within 4 minutes of the big landing wheels hitting tarmac, his highly trained team, with their complex talents and skills, would be in position. Peter straightened up from the map and tucked the notebook under the flap of his button-down breast pocket. Once again, he scrutinized every inch of the silent, battened-down aircraft through his glasses. But this time, he allowed himself the luxury of gut emotion. He felt the anger and the hatred rise from some hidden depth of his soul and flush his blood and tighten the muscles of his belly and thighs. Once again, he was confronted by the many-headed monster. It crouched out there in ambush, waiting for him
as it had so often before. He remembered suddenly the shards of splintered glass littering the cobbles of a Belfast street, and glittering like diamond chips in the arc lamps, the smell of explosives and blood thick in the air. He remembered the body of a young woman lying in the gutted interior of a fashionable London restaurant, her lovely young body stripped by the blast of all but a flimsy pearl-coloured pair of French lace panties. He remembered the smell of a family, father, mother, and three small children, burning in the interior of their saloon car, the bodies blackening and twisting in a slow, macabre ballet as the flame scorched them. Peter had not been able to eat pork since that day. He remembered the frightened eyes of a child through a mask of blood, a dismembered arm lying beside her, the pale fingers still clutching a grubby little rag doll. The images flashed in disjointed sequences across his memory, feeding his hatred until it pricked and stung behind his eyes, and he had to lower the binoculars and wipe his eyes with the back of his hand. It was the same enemy that he had hunted before, but his instincts warned him that it had grown even stronger and more inhuman since last he had met and fought it. He tried to suppress the hatred now, lest it cloud his judgment, lest it handicap him during the difficult hours and days that he knew lay ahead. But it was too powerful, had been too long nurtured. He recognized that hatred was the enemy's vice, that from it sprang their twisted philosophy and their monstrous actions, and that to descend to hatred was to descend to their subhuman levels. Yet still, the hatred persisted. Peter Stride understood clearly that his hatred was not only for the ghastly death and mutilation that he had witnessed so often. More, it was fostered by the threat that he recognized to an entire society and its civilized rule of law. If this evil should be allowed to triumph, then in the future laws would be made by the wild-eyed revolutionary with a gun in his fist. The world would be run by the destroyers instead of the builders. And Peter Stride hated that possibility, more even than the violence and the blood, and those he hated as a soldier hates. For only a soldier truly knows the horror of war. His soldier's instinct now was to immediately engage the enemy and destroy him. But the scholar and philosopher in him warned that this was not the moment, and with an enormous effort of will, he held that fighting man's instinct in check. Yet still he was deeply aware that it was for this moment, for this confrontation of the forces of evil, that he had jeopardized his whole career. When command of Atlas had been plucked away, and a political appointee named in his place, Peter should have declined the offer of a lesser position in Atlas. There were other avenues open to him, but instead he had elected to stay with the project, and he hoped that nobody had guessed at the resentment he felt. God knows Kingston Parker had no cause for complaint since then. There was no harder working officer on Atlas, and his loyalty had been tested more than once. Now all that seemed worthwhile, and the moment for which he had worked had arrived. The enemy waited for him, out there on the burning tarmac, under an African sun, not on a soft green island in the rain, nor in the grimy streets of a crowded city. But still, it was the same old enemy, and Peter knew his time would come. His communications technicians had Colin Noble on the main screen as Peter ducked into the hawker's cabin that was now his command headquarters and settled into his padded seat. On the top right screen was a panoramic view of the southern terminal area, with a Boeing squatting like a brooding eagle upon its nest in the centre of the shot. On the next screen beside it was a blow-up through the 800mm zoom lens of the Boeing's flight deck. So crisp was the detail that Parker could read the maker's name on the tab of the blanket that screened the windshield. The third small screen held a full shot of the interior of the air traffic control tower. In the foreground, the controllers in shirt sleeves, sitting over the radar repeaters, and beyond them, through the floor-to-ceiling windows, still another view of the Boeing. All these were being shot through the cameras installed an hour earlier in the terminal building. The remaining small screen was blank, and Colin Noble's homely, humorous face filled the main screen. "Now, if only it had been the cavalry instead of the US Marines," Peter said, "you'd have been here yesterday." "What's your hurry, pal? Doesn't look like the party has started yet." Colin grinned at him from the screen and pushed his baseball cap to the back of his head. "Damn bright," Peter agreed. "We don't even know who's throwing the party. What's your latest estimate on arrival time?"
"We've picked up a good wind. 1 hour, 22 minutes to fly now," Colin told him.
"Right, let's get down to it," Peter said. And he began his briefing, going carefully over the field notes he had taken. When he wanted to emphasize a point, Peter called for a change of shot from his cameramen, and they zoomed in or panned to his instruction, picking up the radar shed or the service hangar ventilator where Peter was sighting his snipers. The image was repeated not only on the command console, but in the cavernous body of the approaching Hercules, so that the men who would be called to occupy those positions could study them now and prepare themselves thoroughly for the moment. The same images were hurled across the stratosphere to the circling satellite, and from there bounced down to appear, only slightly distorted, on the screens of Atlas Command in the west wing of the Pentagon. Sagging like an old lion in his armchair, Kingston Parker followed every word of the briefing, rousing himself only when a long telex message was passed to him by his assistant. Then he nodded a command to have his own televised image superimposed on Peter's command console.
"I'm sorry to interrupt you, Peter, but we've got a useful scrap here. Assuming that the militant group boarded 070 at Marhay, we asked the Seychelles police to run a check on all joining passengers. There were 15 of them, 10 of whom were Seychelles residents, a local merchant and his wife, and 8 unaccompanied children between 9 and 14 years of age. They are the children of expatriate civil servants employed on contract by the Seychelles government, returning to schools in England for the new term." Peter felt the weight of dread bring down upon him like a physical burden. Children. The young lives seemed somehow more important, somehow more vulnerable. But Parker was reading from the telex flimsy in his left hand, the right scratching the back of his neck with the stem of his pipe. "There is one British businessman, Shell Oil Company, and well known on the island, and there are 4 tourists, an American, a Frenchman, and 2 Germans. These last 4 appeared to be travelling in a group. The immigration and security officers remember them well. 2 women and 2 men, all young. Names: Sally Ann Taylor, 25 years, American. Heidi Hotzhauser, 24, and Gunter Retz, 25, the 2 Germans, and Henri Larousse, 26, the Frenchman. The police have run a back check on the 4. They stayed 2 weeks at the Reef Hotel outside Victoria, the women in 1 double room and the 2 men in another. They spent most of the time swimming and sunbathing, until 5 days ago when a small ocean-going yacht called at Victoria, 35-foot single-hander around the world, skippered by another American. The 4 spent time on board her every day of her stay, and the yacht sailed 24 hours before the departure of the 070. If the yacht delivered their arms and munitions, then this operation has been planned for a long time, Peter pondered, and damn well planned. Peter felt the tingling flush of his blood again. The form of the enemy was taking shape now, the outline of the beast becoming clearer, and always it was uglier and more menacing. "You've run the names through the computer," he asked. "Nothing," Parker nodded. "Either there is no intelligence record of them, or the names and passports are false." He broke off as there was a sudden activity on the screen that monitored the air traffic control tower, and another voice boomed out of the secondary speaker. The volume was set too high, and the technician at the control board adjusted it swiftly. It was a female voice, a fresh, clear, young voice, speaking English with the lilt and inflection of the west coast of America in it. "Jan Smart's tower. This is the officer commanding the task force of the Action Commando for Human Rights that has control of Speedbird 070. Stand by to copy a message." "Contact," Peter breathed. "Contact at last." On the small screen, Colin Noble grinned and rolled his cheroot expertly from one side of his mouth to the other. "The party has begun," he announced.
But there was the razor edge in his voice, not entirely concealed by his jocular tone. The three-man crew had been moved back from the flight deck and were held in the first-class seats vacated by the group of four. Ingrid had made the cockpit of the Boeing her headquarters, and she worked swiftly through the pile of passports, filling in the name and nationality of each passenger on the seating plan spread before her. The door to the galley was open, and except for the hum of the air conditioning, the huge aircraft was peculiarly silent. Conversation in the cabins was prohibited, and the aisles were patrolled by the red-shirted commandos to enforce this edict. They also ordered the use of the toilets. A passenger must return to his seat before another was allowed to rise. The toilet doors had to remain open during use, so that the commandos could check at a glance.